government must do everything it can to avoid collecting information about innocent bystanders, and if it captures that information, it has to delete it as soon as possible, and some other restrictions. The Virginia legislature just earlier this month passed legislation similarly requiring a warrant for stingray use. So we're hoping that more state legislatures around the country will follow their suit.
Anything to be done at the federal level as far as legislation?
Absolutely. You know, Congress is a slow place to try to get things done these days, but there have been a number of members of the U.S. Senate and the House who have raised concerns about stingray technology and other forms of surveillance gear. And so we're watching closely to see whether that turns into legislation or oversight hearings, but there certainly could be a role for Congress.
Well, and we will continue to follow this issue and the use of this stingray technology and other forms of technology used by the CIA, the NSA, and local and state law enforcement in order to create and intercept cell phone create fake cell phone towers to intercept cell phone traffic and, in some occasions, actually control cell phones. Nathan Wessler has joined us today. He is the staff attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union. Nathan, thank you for joining us on KBOO today.
Thank you.
This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Last Days in Vietnam, a film screening on Thursday, March 19th at Concordia University in Portland. Last Days in Vietnam is a new documentary from Rory Kennedy, which examines the final days of American presence in Saigon and the efforts taken to evacuate 135,000 South Vietnamese. Again, that's Last Days in Vietnam, Thursday, March 19th at 6 p.m. at the Hagen Building at Concordia University, 2811 Northeast Holman Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 6:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's time for Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Hey, how's everyone doing? Welcome to KBOO. This is your Labor Radio half hour. My name is Stephanie Patricio. I'm here with Teresa Rayford. And today we're going to be talking about some work that's being done out in the community, specifically around Don't Shoot PDX. Welcome, Teresa.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on, Stephanie.
Yeah. So we spoke back in January, and you had given folks, a lot of information about what was going on. So I think to maximize the time, do you want to let folks know really briefly maybe how Don't Shoot PDX started and what's happened since the beginning of the year?
Oh, absolutely. Well, we started in response to the Mike Brown killing that occurred in August of 2014. Initially, we came together because we had a reaction to something that was devastating. And when we saw the protest that happened because of the murder, and it was children, the reaction was more empathetic than anger. And so we came together as a community, and we were trying to figure out how do we support those youth in Ferguson with what they were doing. And then it just continued to grow. And so, you know, over the last couple of months, we've not only organized community members, but we've done a lot to educate people on different policies and things that they can do to increase public safety within their communities, and also to change laws that feel like they are oppressive or have despairing outcomes for people of color. We want, you know, as an organization, to just get people committed to being engaged in the process so that we can break a system that is not fundamentally benefiting people of color, period. Mm-hmm. And so in January when I came on, it was for your Martin Luther King program. And I know that we talked about the upcoming legislative session. So here we are in March. Mm-hmm. And I think we've been out to Salem probably a half dozen times. I just came back from there on the privacy bill. I'll be back out there tomorrow. Just as an organization, again, we're focusing on root causes and what we can do as people, how we can use our voices, our power, to just change things or to make something new happen. as it pertains to our civil liberties. We don't want to see another Mike Brown.
Mm-hmm. And I heard you say root cause. What does that mean?
Well, when we talk about root causes, we talk about, you know, one of the issues that everybody recognized in Ferguson when Mike Brown was killed was that it was a highly poverty enriched community. Like, people were living in poverty. It was high. It wasn't a lot of crime, though. I had heard that they hadn't had big issues with gang violence or with murders, but there was a lot of poverty in that community, and it was, you know, a really serious, 70% black community. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking to myself, like, well, if they're over-policed, and those were some of the issues that came out of Ferguson, and it's the black community, and they're feeling like this is creating violence, which it was, we have to stop the poverty issue, because that is the root cause of all of this. If we can get the people out of the poverty, then maybe the respect that we receive from law enforcement and even from different government officials, policymakers, all of these people that can deal with these poverty problems on a policy level, maybe we can get more respect from them if we fight those systems and make them recognize who we are. We need to beat the hunger. We need to beat the illiteracy. We have to beat the joblessness, the homelessness. And so when I talk about root causes, I'm talking about beating those things so that we can have a level playing field and create safer societies within our communities. I mean, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I wanted to get to a point, but maybe I actually would love to hear, what are other root causes that you all are working on? What are other things that you see as root causes, as systemic?
Well, basically, one of the things that I'll be in Salem dealing with tomorrow is about, let's say, our children with special needs in our education system. Today, I testified in regards to core standard testing, and they had a subcommittee hearing, and I was able to, you know, provide testimony in regards to that. But those are some of the things. The foster care system, there's a lot of indecent things that are happening to people that are wards of the court. Nobody recognizes that. I don't think there's a clear way to communicate or to file complaints against those systems. I grew up in the foster care system, and I know that a lot of people that's in it, we talk about disadvantaged youth or risk of harm or community crisis. Well, a lot of the people that are creating those problems or that we would look at are people that are already within our system. And so when we talk about root causes, our justice system, you already know the police accountability is top. You know, what we just had, what, last Thursday, the outcome of an acquittal for Tiger Rooley, who was actually, you know, assaulted by the police back in September, right after the Mike Brown situation. And people were asking us, well, why are you doing Know Your Rights training? Well, because the police don't know that we know our rights, and some of us don't. And we need to empower each other, even if it's just with information. So when we talk about root causes, we're talking about what are the needs of the people that live in these communities that are basically being terrorized by our law enforcement, which we all, you know, imagine are supposed to serve and protect us.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that case that you just mentioned?
Tiger Rooley. Well, Judge Diana Stewart just had a ruling in Multnomah County Circuit Court on Thursday the 14th, where she basically acquitted him of charges. He was assaulted by the police and tased because they had received a call that there were some black kids in North Portland, where I live at, kicking over garbages and knocking down signs. So some stuff that kids do, unruly kids. So the police, our Portland police officers, three of them, actually approached these kids that were walking down the street. It wasn't the ones that had been called on, but they ended up assaulting and tasing and basically beating up on this 16-year-old student from Roosevelt High School. And they charged him with assault. And so he had to beat the assault case.
So they charged him with assault.
They charged him with assault. And so the ruling that was just given out of Multnomah County Circuit Court was basically that he was acquitted of all charges and that he was reasonable in his defense. And so, you know, where they told the judge, hey, he tried to strangle me. She said, well, I didn't see that. I saw an aggressive and severe force against this child. And you guys should be ashamed of yourself. I mean, there were remarks that are, you know, going to be held closed, but you can see the information on Oregonian Live. I think they have a link to most of the notes that Maxine took. And so I was happy to see that happen because, you know, of course, since it was a month after Mike Brown was killed, or not even a full month after he was killed, for this little boy to make it through that situation with three grown officers assaulting him, to make it out alive with no real serious issues, and then to fight for his rights and to win, I think that that should be national news right now. But I know that our city has a good PR image that they're always trying to maintain. And so you don't hear a whole lot about it. You hear about the outcome. And the first thing I noticed in the news was that they called it a tussle. And I'm like, a tussle? So when did tasing and beating the mess out of a child, three grown trained officers, become a tussle? That's not a tussle. Not unless it was a one-sided tussle. He was being assaulted. So I think I might have told you a couple minutes ago that I did send a letter to Chief O'Day, and I copied in Mayor Hill's office along with the president of the Oregon Assembly for Black Affairs and Joanne Hardesty and some other people from our community, asking for the dismissal of those officers.
What do you expect the outcome to be?
I expect them to be dismissed as officers. They've breached public trust. Even the judge in her ruling said that the testimony given by Ms. Hornstein was not credible. And so if you would lie in a court of law.
Is she an officer?
She's an officer. Yeah. She's one of the ones. She's the one that said he was strangling her. But I don't know if you've seen the video or not. There wasn't a time that he had the opportunity to even put his arm around her. And everything that he was doing was defensive. They were pulling his hair and all kinds of stuff on that video. And so when I saw the outcome, I thought, you know, it only makes sense for those officers to be dismissed. They have breached public trust. That ruling does, it should create a precedent, especially since Chief O'Day has said since the beginning of his term that he was going to change the culture of our policing system. So I'm hoping he holds himself accountable to doing that. I think it's the right thing to do. And especially, let's say, in the court of law, it's already been said, so.
Okay. Yeah, and I think, you know, and hearing you talk to and this last case, I hear that you write a letter, right? You write a letter that people are present at the court, maybe are behind this young man, or you're down in the legislature. Down at the Capitol for the legislative session. And so I wonder about how communities do that work, right? How they address root systems, how they address and maybe fight against the causes, right, of the violence, of systemic isolation, whatever it may be. And I wonder what your take on it is. Like, is your focus in Salem? Or how else does Don't Shoot PDX do work?
My focus is really on the community. I'm hoping that we can do enough outcome work, like with Ty. If we can do, as a community, enough courageous things that gets our voices on the record making change happen, I think that we can start carrying those stories and that movement to Salem, and we can really change policy, and we can implement policy, and we can amend constitutional laws that are supposed to protect our civil liberties, because it's just a clear violation. There's so many systems that are being held accountable out in Ferguson because of all of the audits and investigations, and I'm just hoping that we can create that same type of trend here in Oregon. You know, when we talk about the foster care system, when you have people graduating out of that system and saying, I've been molested, or I've been abused, or I was, you know, whatever the issue is, let's start making it common practice to file those complaints and take them seriously, because it shouldn't be acceptable. If a child going to visit with a family member while they are a ward of the court can pose a risk of harm, well, why isn't the abuse that's happening within that home considered risk of harm? When we're talking about homeschooling, there's a certain standard that parents have to oblige to in order to get an actual graduation or a GED for their children. But within our school system, they can fail 43% of minority students, and where is the accountability there, you know? So it's just using our voices not to just talk to each other, but to start talking to these people that make these decisions and just holding them accountable to doing what is right by us. And knowing what's right and wrong, you know, it's self-accountability. And so my focus is in our community, but at the same time, we take those community voices back and forth to Salem. We got a long legislative session. There's a lot of work that we can do from now until July.
Yeah, I definitely hear that. And so what are some things that you all are working on specifically?
Yeah, I was going to say, well, of course, you know, when we talk about poverty, we're talking about a living wage. And so we've been very big components and opponents of the 15 now. We've been running around with Justin and Jamie and everybody rallying out in Salem, doing things here locally. We were, you know, shutting down Christmas trees and stuff like that in December. And, you know, just doing whatever we can to help get that passed, because I know that Portland just said that they'll pay city workers, and I know that the county said they'll pay county workers, but we need to pay everybody within not only the city of Portland, but within the state of Oregon, to go ahead and create a level playing field for people that live in poverty. If poverty is the direct result of all of our crime, if we're saying we got all these criminal systems, and we got, at some point we have to think about investing in the economic development to get people out of poverty in order to fight this issue, because continuously putting money into law enforcement is only creating a bigger problem. So the 15 Now agenda, we're pushing for that. Again, fighting core standard testing, because we don't want to help promote the school to prison pipeline. We have a lot of children with special needs and IEPs and just basically poverty, and that's used against them in our school system. And whether it's direct or indirectly or malicious, the intent and the outcome is still bad when we look at graduation rates or when we look at the success of students. I'm working right now with a lot of kids who are, you know, new graduates from high school, and when I look at their writing or anything that they put in front of me, it's very clear that they're not getting the same education that I got back in the 70s and the 80s, you know, and there's something wrong with that, because the education should be more progressive and they should have a better chance at a higher education, or at least a focus towards a job or industry or a career. But I'm looking at the education and what the assets are on paper that they give me, and it's not enough. They're not competitive for the workforce that we have right now. So if they're going to be forced to work at a McDonald's or a Wendy's or whatever, let's make sure that it's enough to get them level. And then let's look at different things that we can do as a society to help them bridge that gap between their education and, you know, their success as far as, you know, later on home ownership and family planning and things of that sort. But what we're looking for is a cultural change. And I think a lot of it stems from the accountability that we as people have to start taking into consideration. We're more powerful than we know, and we have to start identifying that power and using it. We can pull ourselves out faster than anybody else can pull us.
And so in hearing you talk, you mentioned the fight for 15 Now.
Yes.
Right? And so I can see that as a direct link to worker struggle. How else does Don't Shoot PDX fight for and interact or cross with a worker struggle?
Oh my goodness. Well, most of the people that we represent can't get jobs because of our legal system. They've been hit with felonies for driving while black, or, you know, a bag of bud that is considered a different type of crime, or they've been called violent because of the people that they live around, even if they've never had any kind of violent incident in their life. And so that's bridging a wall between them and an economic opportunity regardless. And so I'm just hoping that if we can get a 15 Now, if we can work with the labor movement and identify that everybody deserves access to a job that can help them take care of their families, that there will be more job opportunities available, and that people that are, you know, historically couldn't find jobs could probably start building their own bases, or they can get a chance. I know right now we've been pushing for Ban the Box, and we're hoping that that goes. That's going to help a lot of people. If they take that box off and you don't have to put on there or figure out if you want to put on there, there's people that lie about it. And then they only not get, or the people say, well, we're not giving it to you because you could have told us the truth up front. And they're like, whatever, you know, because I've done that. And so, I mean, just taking that away will make it a better advantage. So, I mean, if we talk about my community and who I represent, you know why I'm talking to Labor Radio. We need an opportunity, and it doesn't always have to be a handout. It needs to be a hand up. It needs to be something where we can leverage, you know.
And so I think part of that is communication, too. It's not just a one-sided thing. So in what ways is the labor movement there? Or is the labor movement there?
They're coming there. They've been connecting with us, and I think that they've been excited that we've been interested in connecting with them, because when I started working with a lot of the labor people, I didn't see a whole bunch of people that looked like me, and if I did, I'd see them over on a table somewhere quiet in the back, and I didn't understand why they're not in the front, and I'm hoping that we can change that. I don't know if it's a consciousness that we have that maybe we're not, you know, in. There's, I mean, you know how the segregated society that we live in, you feel like a second-class citizen. I feel like one every day when I walk out of my house. And so you're in a group of people that you guys have a common goal, but you still feel like your voice doesn't matter. You still feel like you're not, you know, I don't know how to make somebody feel what I've been feeling my whole life, but you just don't feel like you belong unless you have some value in it. You have to put teeth in it. So that's why, again, encouraging people to use their voices. If they're in the labor movement and they're at those meetings, start speaking up. Don't worry about if the question you're going to ask is a dumb question or somebody else asked it, or if it sounds like you're not listening. Just do it anyway. Just become a part of the process. And that's going to take a lot of courage, because we've been shut down so much. And particularly in the Black community, and I know other communities of color, we have people that speak on behalf for us. They're not always saying what needs to be said, and we have to push them out of the way and start speaking for ourselves, because that also makes us feel like we don't have to use our voice. Well, we got so-and-so talking for us. That's not working. Mm-hmm. It hasn't worked. Mm-hmm. We're still where we are. They're not going to fight for you as hard as you can fight for yourself. So we have to continue to encourage that, and that's what we've been doing through the movement. You know, when we go out there and we're protesting, we're passing the bullhorn to everybody, and people who have never publicly spoken out are telling 100 people what to do, or 200 or 300 people what to do, and we're all following them because harmoniously we know that our end goal is the same. So if we're going to get to the outcome, your voice matters as much as mine. And if you're not loud enough, I'm going to go ahead and chant what you're saying. And I think we have to do that everywhere. We just create it. Use your voice.
To switch gears a little bit, I've wanted to, and I think I've heard people, you know, comment or say that tactic is also always an important facet of any kind of revolution, any kind of progressive change, right? And I wonder what your thoughts are on, I know that in any group that there's rifts, right? Or just a headbutting or egos. A disagreement or egos, right? And so I wonder, I would love to hear from you about maybe that cropping up in all of the movements that are taking place in response to Ferguson, right? Because there are many, right? It's not just one, right? Or, yes, it's
There's
one.
There's global movements in regards to Ferguson, and I'm privy to having access to about 2.5 million people through my online networks, because I got several different pages, and I do contact and talk to a lot of different people that are on the ground level in different parts of the country and the world, and everybody's experiencing what feels like COINTELPRO and things of that sort. And I think it's just because it's all brand new. What I've done as far as, you know, I surround myself with people that are loyal, and people that aren't, I don't really focus on them too much, because we know that the outcomes that we want are the same, unless they are probably not on our side. And I have, you know, great friends like the ACLU and different legal organizations that help us stay focused, because they provide us the legal structuring and focus that we need. We can come out here and we can say, hey, we want to fight the power, but if we don't understand the legal process, we can't fight the power. We're just going to lose our voices. And so for people that are having those issues, the thing is to keep your eye on the prize, just to continue looking forward, have the blinders on, and think about what your goal is. If your goal is to break this system and create something new, then you have to use education as the asset, and you can't let anybody's ego override your action. You just have to continue being active. And you know, you might have 1,000 people one day and 3 people the next day, but those 3 people being focused and cohesive is going to get you further than those 1,000 people with various voices fighting and arguing. We just have to stay focused. I think we'll all come back together. I think that if people are genuinely interested in better outcomes for community members that are at a disadvantage when it comes to engagement with law enforcement or government, you know, resources, that we'll do the right thing at some point and put the action in front of the ego. We have to realize that this is not a movement that you can own. There are a lot of people who have lost their lives, who have lost their family members, their victim survivors like myself. And we're not going to stop. We're not on this because of it's a trend or anything like that. I was out there in the streets trying to educate and advocate for my community ever since September 26th of 2010 when my nephew died. And it didn't stop and it didn't slow down when Ferguson happened. It just gave me more work to do as far as getting community members that felt the same sadness and passion a direction and a goal to forward to. And so it's like, nope, go ahead and throw this into that bag and let's just keep going forward. And so we have a couple more steps moving forward so we don't lose that genuine, you know, advocacy goal.
How do you take care of yourself?
My community. Now, that's what I just told Jan from the ACLU. She was like, well, how do you survive? Because I know that when you're asking for accountability, it's pretty hard. And I was like, yeah, it is, because people call you everything from a whistleblower to, you know, and I'm like, all I want is accountability. When did that become a bad thing? But I was telling her that the community takes care of me, even when I don't want to be taken care of.
How? What do they do?
Like, they do everything. Kids bought my shoes. You know, like, people take care of me. I'm from Portland, so I have the advantage of being able to do this 24 hours a day, 7 days a week since my nephew died, without a care or a worry of where I'm going to lay my head or how I'm going to feed myself or what I'm going to wear, because my community, even if you don't see them on the front lines, they're why I look good. Even my hair today, I'm like, oh, no, I went to the Capitol looking like Nicki Minaj. That's my friend. You know, she took care of me. She was like, you're not going to be out here looking like that. You come to my house, and even made me go to sleep. You know, so the community that I advocate for takes care of me, and so they force me to take care of myself even when I feel like I got too much to do. And so that's where I leverage my support.
And so does that matter to
absolutely
movements?
Because yeah, it makes you stay going. Mm-hmm. You keep on going because the people that you're doing it for, they genuinely love you and care about you. They're not like the systems you're fighting. They love you, and they'll love you if you stop. So with that kind of endearing loyalty, you won't stop. You know, you won't, and I won't.
That's great. And so maybe in these last couple minutes, what are a couple things that you want to say to folks listening?
Well, I was going to say that if you don't mind, I would like to read to you the letter that I sent to Chief O'Day, and I'm asking community members to do the same thing. Sure. We need to get those guys dismissed. Okay,
sure.
So it goes like this. Chief Larry O'Day, I hope all is well with you, as it has been several weeks since I've had the opportunity to speak with you. I'm sending this correspondence to create a public plea regarding a public safety matter. It has come to my attention and others in the community that via the verdict on Thursday, March 14, 2015, in the courtroom of Judge Diana Stewart in Multnomah County Circuit Court, that three officers sworn to protect and serve residents in the city of Portland have breached the trust and are at this point a considerable risk of harm to several vulnerable members in our community. Now, the officers in question are Betsy Hornstein, David Hughes, and Sergeant Jason Lyle, who willingly and together ganged up and caused bodily harm, including the violation of constitutional liberties of Ty Garuli, a 16-year-old minor and resident of North Portland. Now, in regards to the incident, which took place on September 14, 2014, it was stated by Judge Diana Stewart that the show of force was senseless and aggressive. She went on to say that Officer Betsy Hornstein was not credible in her statements given for the reporting of the incident. Now, I'm concerned that the public safety is at risk, and I make this statement without knowledge of your intention to keep these officers employed within the Bureau. Now, I don't believe that it's unlikely that their gang-like actions and activities on September 14 represent a culture within the Portland Police Bureau that has existed for at least the time that I've lived in Oregon, which is back in 1970 when I was born. Now, due to the judgment in Multnomah County, I do feel that it has opened an opportunity for community members to adopt a culture of stepping up when they encounter these type of peace officers. I believe that by showing a model of discipline which is able to restore the public faith in these officers with the sworn duty, that you will also show a goal of accountability and responsibility for those you command and those like myself who you serve. Now, again, Chief O'Day, I hope that this letter reaches you in good health, and it makes a statement that in respect to the judge's ruling, thus allowing us all to recognize that an attitude test could have caused this youth and others to not only suffer the assault that was witnessed on September 4th, but could have also resulted in the loss of life, as it has across the country in almost every 28 hours, to young men of color who may not have been aware of their constitutional rights at the time of these assaults. And I'm sorry, at the time of the police harassment that they are subjected to as members of society. Now, I have to further acknowledge that in regards to the actions for mutual public safety, that the immediate dismissal of these officers is being formally requested by members of the public who are working to engage with coalitions who believe that public safety is something that we should all be accountable and striving towards. Now, we will look forward to a prompt response to this plea for safety and solidarity with community-based policing efforts and the state's accountability to safety for all of its residents. So I kind of my computer was dying while I was trying to read that to you. But I'm hoping that he takes this very seriously, that he does dismiss these officers. And I'm hoping that someone within the state's capitol, and hopefully our attorney general and some of our legislators, look to prosecute these officers for these crimes against this young man, because he was acquitted in a court of law and he was reasonable in his focus on self-defense and safety for his personal safety. So
great.
Did the right thing, right?
Yeah. Is there anywhere folks can plug in?
For that one or for they can find us on Facebook. We're Don't Shoot Portland on Facebook. You can Google us and find some other things that are happening. But if you go to our Facebook page, in the last week, I think we've gotten like another 1,600 likes, so we're a little bit over 3,000. But we have events coming up. We have a grand jury training coming up the first week of April. We just moved over to the bus project for our work group meetings, and we're going to have a different structure of committee focus for our shifts in those meetings, looking at utilizing their resources, because again, it's legislative session and that's what they do. So we'll be doing that once a week. And then we've also have a hopefully some good news coming out of Portland State University as far as doing some more things with Don't Shoot PSU and making sure that we support you guys in the safety there on campus. And I've sent a message to my friend over at PCC, Karen, who's the president of the college, and I'm going to hopefully see if we can become a community partner so that we can use those campus sites to promote the Know Your Rights training and other legislative actions that community members can have access to. Because, again, we don't have resources.
Yeah.
So if community partners have access to resources, we're just asking them to make sure that they're available to us so that we can continue our efforts of public community engagement.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for your work.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
You're my hero. Thank you.
You're mine.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up. It's Labor Radio.
Tune in to Ear to the Streets of Portland on March 19th for an interview with special guest Bay Area recording artist Goapele, who will be performing at this year's KBOO-sponsored event, Sold Out Music Festival, on April 15th. It's a night of special guests and performances on Ear to the Streets of Portland with Goapele and local artists Arietta Ward and friends, March 19th starting at 7 o'clock.